Hello, I'm Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership. And it's my pleasure to have Dr. Luis Mendoza, who is a professor at Arizona State University, who's going to talk about his new book on Live Places Publishing. The title of the book is Reconstructing Memory, Place, and Identity in 20th Century Houston, a memoir on family and being Mexican-American in Space City, USA. Luis, welcome to the program.
My pleasure being here. Thank you so much for hosting me, Darrell.
That's great. Before we jump into your latest book, could you share with our audience a little bit about your education and background?
Absolutely. So I grew up in a family of eight kids in inner city Houston, and my parents were first generation immigrants from northern Mexico. They believed in the power of education to, create better opportunities, quality of life, job opportunities. They wanted us to be socially mobile. And my dad always, one of the things he always liked to say is, you want to get a job in which you're not outside, the heat of Texas, where you're working with your hands because it'll wear your body down. And both of my grandparents just manifested that hard work of working on railroads, working in the shipyards, working in the cotton fields of Texas. They had stooped backs and, they lived a good life, but it was hard on their bodies.
Yeah.
And so they believed in the power of education, and they sent us as best they could to good schools in our little neighborhood, in a little neighborhood called Denver Harbor. We went to a Catholic elementary school and then went on. Some of us at that time for a while, that Catholic school went to eighth grade and they went to a Catholic high school. Some of us, including myself, spent 2 years at the public junior high in our neighborhood and then went on to private high school. And they were either in that time, all boys or all girls schools. So I would say we had really good education compared to the public education at that time. And these were college prep schools. So they may sound very privileged, and it was. It cost. We had to work after school to help pay for our tuition and that kind of stuff. But it was, there were also some cost to going to these schools for us that I'll talk about later. But nevertheless, I will say this is that I experienced so much hostility in my high school that I felt like I told myself, if this is preparing me for college, I don't want to go. And wow. Even though I had scholarships to go to several universities, I disappointed my parents, and my former social rebellion against them was saying, I'm not going to college and I'm just going to go work. And I worked at a place that rented out construction equipment. It was kind of hard work, hot work. And, it was only several years later in my early 20s that I went to a community college to take a small engine repair class, and being in the school environment, all of a sudden my mind lit up and I said, oh, I forgot how much I love this. I love to read. I love to learn. I love to expand my mind. And so I started going to school on my own, and it took me, almost 8 years putting myself through school, working full time.
Wow.
But by the time I finished, I wasn't ready to stop, and it was actually at the behest of one of my professors who said, you should go on to graduate school. I goes, I can get you a job being a teacher in a high school if you want, but I really think you should go on to graduate school. And I said, really, what is that? I had no idea what graduate school was because I was a first generation college graduate as it was.
Right.
And they said, well, it's a continuation and you learn, and you could possibly teach in a community college or a university. I said, well, that sounds interesting. I don't know if I'm, I didn't have a lot of faith in myself. I said, I don't know if I can, if I'm that made of that kind of stuff, but I'll go check it out. And so I'm sort of the worst example of applying to graduate school. I applied to one place only because it was nearby. And this happened to be a very, very good school, the University of Texas at Austin. And I literally drove up there on the day applications were due to hand in my application. And, and it's the only place I applied, which that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to apply to a bunch of places. And fortunately, I got in and I moved there, and there was the best 6 years of my life was being in grad school, where my mind just exploded because I was learning so much and growing so much. And, and I didn't even know that I was admitted to a PhD program. I thought I was just going for a master's. And at some point they said, so do you want your PhD to be in this or in this? And I said, well, I'm in the PhD program. And so they said, yeah. And I said, well, that's great. Anyway, so it was this wonderful experience, and I had great mentors and teachers there.
And what did you get your PhD in?
My PhD is in English with a emphasis in ethnic and third world literatures.
Wow.
Yeah. And within that, I concentrated in the Chicana literature,
Yes.
people of Mexican descent. Yeah.
Beautiful. And so what inspired you to write this book?
So my career in academia, my scholarship has really been all about trying to help people better understand the experience of Latinos in the United States. You know, and again, I grew up in a time and place where we weren't always welcome in society. You know, we were kind of treated as second-class citizens. And I always tell people that, and this was very crucial to me, it wasn't until I was the age of 25 in an undergraduate class in the University of Houston downtown, I took a class called Mexican American Literature. And that was the first time in my life I read anything by a person of Mexican descent. And
Really?
I was 25, and this is 1985 at this time. And I had read African American authors in my sophomore year of high school. And that blew my mind in itself because I lived in inner city Houston. I was surrounded on three sides by different African American neighborhoods, historical neighborhoods. And I was like, wow, this is great. I'm learning so much. But, you know, I always assumed we didn't have a literature, you know, because I just didn't know any better. Nobody ever put that in front of us in high school. And
Right.
instead, we were sort of the brunt of jokes because Texas has a long and in long-standing animosity with people of Mexican descent because it was once Mexico. And so there was always about, you know, jokes about the Alamo and this and that. And so it blew my mind to be exposed to this literature. And all of a sudden, you know, after I took so long, partly one of the reasons I took so long to get my undergraduate degree was I was exploring different things. You know, at first I was like very many young people thinking, I want to do get a degree and something that's going to make me a lot of money. You know, I explored accounting, I explored computer science, I explored engineering, all these things that when I took the classes for me, they fit other people. They bored me to tears.
Right.
And I said, I can't imagine doing this. And I finally just sort of had this talk with myself, you know, what would I really want to do? And what, you know, honestly, what's going to make me happy? Because it's going to be such a big part of my life.
Hey,
And I
right.
said, well, I love to read. I love to write, you know, and so for me, literature seemed a natural place to gravitate toward those classes. And this Mexican American literature class just opened my eyes up in a way that I began to understand. It, you know, before as a young person, reading was always about sort of escape. It was about expanding my horizons. It's about me entering into the lives of other people's experiences, which is one of the beautiful things about literature, right? But all of a sudden, when I read stories that reflected my life experience, it was even more eye-opening because I'm like, wow, I can relate in a different, as a, in a way that parallels my life experience. I can understand deeper
Right.
in a way. And this is about me. And now I am, you know, I and my community are equally important as everybody else who has their literature. And
Yes. Yes.
so it was amazing to all of a sudden have my world completed. And my vision of life and, you know, past, present, and future. So that was why I sort of chose to keep studying it beyond my undergraduate degree. And of course, you know, you go to graduate school, if you started being exposed to critical theory, you start getting a different kind of language, different tools for analysis, and you have a much broader and deeper understanding of the world we live in.
Wow. And so when you think about your motivation to write this book, what is it that you hope that the audience comes away after they finish reading it? What is the two or three things that you hope resonates with them?
Sure. Well, several things. One of the things that I make a point of saying in the book is that because I, you know, I have to ask myself the question, why is my story worth telling? You know, because I'm not really a vain person who thinks, oh, well, I'm so exceptional. But I love literature because of the way in which we can see a broad array of people represented. And so I part of it was saying I wanted to have my experience and my community, my humble little community where I grew up, my family represented in the panorama of literature, and that it was, I believe everybody's important. I'm kind of egalitarian, I'm a humanist. And so I think we are all equally important and that we all have a story to tell. And that while we have lots in common, the nuances are what make it interesting to know somebody, right? Like you and I could sit down and, realize we have a we share a love about a lot of things, but it's going to be the differences that also make it really worthwhile knowing somebody, And so I wanted this to share my particular experience about growing up because I wanted to see to do justice to my family. And because another thing is that as a second generation immigrant, one thing I had learned is that my parents did not talk about the past. They really saw life before, their parents' lives as something that was what we left behind, and that they had a kind of, they were born in the late 1920s during right when the Great Depression was starting. And they had a kind of survivalist mentality of like, let's buckle down, put our heads down, not cause any trouble, not cause any extra undue attention on ourselves. And let's get through the hard times because we, they operated by a certain amount of faith. There are better days ahead, but let's not look backwards, let's look forwards. And so they didn't dwell on how the very harsh experiences they had as youngsters. It's only as a, I minored in Mexican American studies and then eventually came sort of an expert in it. But I would talk to them about what I was learning. And only when I could show them that there were people writing about this and people were talking about it, could they say, oh yeah, I can relate to that. Let me tell you something. And they had lots of stories to tell that, and at some point, they raised us to be English only speakers. That is, they didn't raise us to be bilingual, even though they were, because language was a burden for them that they had to overcome. And they received a lot of undue negative attention before they learned to speak English. And so it was a source of shame. And this was part of, it's part of colonialism, right? We, until you get your culture and language and identity squeezed out of you and you assimilate, you're a problem, And so this was part of the process that they underwent. And they tried to spare us that. And I know it was well intended, but the reality is the color of our skin got us the kind of attention we didn't want anyway. People would make all kinds of assumptions about us.
And now, like my nephew, Gaffney Jr., his wife is from, he's going to shoot me. I'm trying to remember, a country in South America. It starts with an E.
Ecuador?
Ecuador. She's from Ecuador, and I love it because his kids are totally bilingual.
My son, who's 11 years old, his mother's Colombian, and he speaks perfect Spanish. I mean, people are always talking about how amazing it is, how bilingual he is. He reads English and Spanish, he talks it. He can go to Latin America and get along much better than me. And he's my translator, which is kind of funny, right? Because we, I didn't grow up without it, but now he knows it. And so he's much more fluent than me.
Well, it's so good. Being bilingual is such an asset versus when, as you said, when your parents are coming through, it was something that they didn't want to because it was considered to be, like you said, the colonialism for that. Wow.
Yeah,
And
so let me, I'm sorry, and I didn't quite, I still realize I'm kind of not avoiding, but I'm not fully answering your question. So writing this book was a way of doing a couple of things, documenting my family history, as I said, and my family's journey to the United States as immigrants and our own kind of survival story. But it was also about telling the story about Houston, because Houston, unlike say San Antonio or Tucson or other sort of important Spanish colonial cities in the Southwest, is not one of those cities. It really only comes of age in the 20th century. And this is the time when my family is moving to Texas as well, because they're fleeing the Mexican Revolution and the Industrial Revolution is taking place in the United States, and they're looking for a lot of workers. And so again, this is America's love-hate relationship with immigrants, right? When times are good and we have lots of jobs, we want you to come. When things are bad, we wish you weren't here. But at that time, they were really recruiting many, many migrants to come, and they were experiencing a hard time in Mexico, so they came. And this is a side of my family history I knew nothing about. I mean, I knew we were from Mexico, and we had visited one small village one time, but I couldn't tell you anything about my great grandparents, and my grandparents themselves actually never learned English. So we could communicate and get along, but we couldn't talk like in detail. And so that was just kind of this blank canvas for me. And of course, now, not only do I have the capacity to do research, but there's all these tools like ancestry.com and, you know, all these things can help you find, you know, firsthand documents on this primary documents. And so I decided, you know, my parents, about 10 years ago, I sat down with them and spent about 9 to 10 hours interviewing them and just pulling everything I could out of them. You know, and my sisters were there and we just asked questions and got them talking, got all kinds of anecdotes. And I always told myself I was going to do something. Well, a couple of years ago, they both passed away, but I told myself, this is the time to do that in honor of them, you know? So for me, this was like an obligation I had to not only, you know, help honor them, but to also for my son, for my nephews, nieces and nephews, so they will never have to deal with not knowing our story.
Wow, that is huge. When you think about the value to your family of teaching them about things that were before them, and how they can pass it on to their children because you have your printed volume. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Professor Luis Menendez, who has written a phenomenal book titled Reconstructing Memory, Place, and Identity in 20th Century Houston, a memoir on family and being Mexican American in Space City, USA. We chuckled earlier. When I said Space City, I said, is that Houston? He goes, is there any other place?
Well, yeah.
And so, can you talk about if things have changed? Because I know when you were in high school, you weren't treated very well. Has your son experienced any of that? Or
is I think we do live in a very different world. I mean, there are still lots of legacies of racism in our society. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And unfortunately, you don't have to look very hard to find lots of examples of racial hostility and, you know, violence and these sort of things. But it's not quite as bad. And I think that one of the things that the civil rights movement did, and with good strategy that communities of color in this country did, was to begin to tell their story, was to seize control of their own narratives and say, you're not going to tell my story anymore. I'm going to tell our story because right. I have, you know, my version is authentic to me. And so there's a lot more examples of where we can go to find information. And I think that, you know, there are many debates now about what you can and cannot or should not teach in schools, or what books can or cannot or should not be in libraries. The fact of the matter is there's a lot more stuff out there and people are finding creative ways to get it in people's hands. And it's hard to deny. And there's also, there has, I think, been a kind of a, something of a cultural mind shift with people, including non-people of color, who become informed about our experiences and saying, you know what, I support that. I believe in a multicultural society. I believe that, you know, it's a point of pride in who we are as a country to acknowledge the great diversity of our experiences here, rather than people who want to pretend that somehow we're not diverse or that not we're only one racial or ethnic group belongs here. You know, so that's an ongoing debate, but I also think that we have made progress. So that motivates a lot of what I do, is to be part of that larger effort to raise people's, you know, awareness, their educational level about this, and to create, to put stuff in people's hands that can provide, you know, a way for them to take in that knowledge and to share it with others and to be aware of it.
So, you know, you talked about that epiphany moment that you had when you took a community college course and you go, wait a minute. I like this. This is good for me. What other epiphany moments have you had in your life that has helped you to provide value added knowledge to your family and your community?
Well, lots of things. I mean, I think it's been important for me to acknowledge that even as I write about my community, and I've done so in different ways in different times, is that there aren't one perspective. Every person has a different, you know, it's just like they say about photographs or an accident. You know, if you have eight different people that see something, they're going to have eight different recollections of that.
Right.
And as much as I consulted with my family, I could talk to my parents, I talked to my siblings, you know, they still want to look at sometimes what I write and say, that's not how I remember it. You know, or I think of this, and they have little differences of opinion. And so I think what I try to say very clearly in this book is, even though I'm trying to represent my story, my family story, my community story, that it's really only my perspective. And I believe that I can say that and still honor other people's perspectives, because they're not necessarily in contradiction to one another. They're just slightly different nuances, different versions of the same story, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I use the image of a kaleidoscope to talk about sometimes my past. If it's fragmented, I'm not sure where all the pieces go. It's, you know, kind of, I see some beautiful things in there, but sometimes it only comes together when you try and turn it into a narrative, to take the story. And that may be only momentary in the sense that it doesn't mean it's completely represents everything, but it's one snapshot in time, you know?
Right. And so, again, after the reader completes the book, what is your hope that they'll come away with, and what information do you hope that they glean that is very important to understand? How do we go along and get along in this country with all the different cultures that we have?
Well, one of the things that I do is document how over three different generations, my family has experienced similar things, but also transformation. Houston has transformed from a cow town, from an oil, even the oil boom town, into a much more metropolitan, multicultural, multi-ethnic, cosmopolitan town that is learned to understand the diversity of the city and its residents as an asset rather than as a liability. It no longer makes pretense of like, you know, we're in the, it's this old fashioned Western town that, you know, there's those who dominate, there's those who are dominated. I think there's a great effort, and this is shown in even in electoral politics over the years, when we've elected African-American mayors, gay mayors, we still have never elected a Latino mayor, but there've been plenty of Latino power players in town. And I think that's probably going to be in the future, but that the city doesn't fall apart when there are different leaders, you know, and in fact, it's grown, and it's one of the most interesting cities now, in which there may still be, and I'm sure there is, because it has a legacy of really harsh redlining and really harsh segregation policies that are still there, but they blurred. And the newer parts of town are no longer marked only for sort of one ethnic group. I mean, you know, we could find easily examples of, you know, some of those racial covenants in housing that say this house was, you know, a non-white person may not live in this house, you know, or a Jewish person may not live here. And so there are all that evidence that those legacies still exist, but people have actively been going back to courts. And even though nobody enforces them, they're saying, we want these things removed. You know, we don't want the stain of that to blemish our image. And so I do think the city is in a much better place. That doesn't mean it's idealized. I grew up loving my neighborhood, but it was also a neighborhood in which we were told, when you grow up, the mark of success is to get away from it. You know, so I appreciate people who have stayed still and tried to improve those neighborhoods.
Right.
I understand that they're in some ways better off now and they're undergoing change. But I don't want to idealize them either, because there was conflict and poverty and domestic violence and all those things that make up life. And I wouldn't want to glorify those either, but that's also the stuff of life, right?
Right.
It's just
right.
complicated and messy.
Right, right. And so when you look at what's going on in Arizona on the political side, what do you think the two or three main goals for the Latino community to achieve in Arizona?
Well, it's really interesting that you ask. You know, Houston is the fourth largest city and Phoenix is the fifth largest city. So Arizona, and people often talk about, it's funny because you talk to people in Texas, they'll say, you live in Arizona now? And you talk to people in Arizona, they say, you're from Texas? Like, you know, there's some liability to being from one place to the other. And it's tough. But, you know, Arizona itself is a good example of change. It has until recently, it was a red state, and now people talk about it as a purple state. There
Say.
have been changes made, but it is the fast one of the. It's definitely Phoenix is the fastest growing city in the country. I mean, there are like 1,000 people a week who move here, something like that. And it
Really?
is,
Wow.
yes, oh yes, it continues to grow, and it has many challenges. I mean, the homeless population is really large here. It is still learning that it can honor the diversity of its residents and be respectful without having to have the mentality of somebody like Joe Arpaio, who Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who made his name by imprisoning migrants and parading them around to humiliate them and sort of catering to the worst sentiments of people, and so I think we have people who are replacing them and getting elected that I think are representative of the future. We're going to try and get along better. We're trying to be more respectful. And yeah.
So are you planning to take your book on tour to lecture at different universities?
I hope to do some of that. I've presented it at conferences. I was in Atlanta last month and I gave a conference paper there. It was well received. And I'm hoping to do some touring. It's a little bit hard because I've started a new job as an associate dean and I've got a really busy schedule. So I haven't quite had the chance to reach out. But as it gets known a little bit, I'm sure people ask me. And this is not uncommon with people books that come out of people in academia. There's a little bit of a lag time between a
Sure.
book coming out and people knowing about it. But I do know of a few people that are going to be teaching in their classroom, and they've already asked me to give a talk on Zoom, if nothing else, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Well, I'm an adjunct faculty at Seton Hall University,
Great.
and Dr. Forrest Pritchard, I'm going to make sure that I introduce you to him.
Wonderful.
He's a man of all seasons. Right now, he's the acting dean of the African American
Studies.
studies, and
Oh.
because they had it when I was there attending Seton Hall back in the late 70s, early 80s, we had an African studies program, and then they got rid of it,
Oh,
and
God.
now it's back. So, but yeah, but I got to talk to David Parker, your publisher, because I think that a Live Places Publishing lecture series featuring.
Yeah,
The
there's a
topic
lot of good.
that you and your colleagues are talking about are really so timely and so spot on in educating the marketplace. So, believe it or not, we are running out of time,
All right.
but I wanted to give you the last words that you would like to share with our audience about your book.
Well, what I would want to say is that I learned, I ended up finishing this book and feeling richer than ever with my family's experience. I sort of mined their memories. I listened to their words. I used them as a guidepost. And it helped validate for me a view of life that we are all have fascinating stories to tell. I don't think my story is necessarily, like I said, exceptional, but if anything, I hope it's somewhat representative of other people's lives. And I think I would hope that other people would embrace that view that they need to dig a little bit into their past. They need to honor their ancestors and leave a legacy for the future that somebody can actually hold on to and share.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Professor Luis Mendoza, and his book is Reconstructing Memory, Place, and Identity in 20th Century Houston, a memoir on family and being Mexican American in Space City, USA. Professor Mendoza, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much, Darrell. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, that wraps it up for on Leadership with Darrell W. Gunter. And as always, we want you to have a great day. But remember, leadership begins with you.